Welcome to Deep Dive MH370, Episode 29, Motive. Hello, I'm Andy Tarnoff, the publisher and founder of OnMilwaukee.com, a daily magazine and media company based in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I'm joined again by Jeff Wise, aviation journalist, author of The Taking of MH370, and also my co-host through like 26, 27 hours of this awesome podcast. Welcome back, Jeff.
Thank you, Andy. We have an exciting one today. This is something that really people have been asking for a while, almost from the beginning, really, because as we have been presenting this sort of alternate vision, sort of complementary to the kind of common sense consensus about what happened to MH370, which is the idea that the plane was hijacked to the north, people have said, it's really the first thing people have said to me always, what's the motive? Why would they do this?
And
my answer, Andy, has always been, well, first of all, we can't start with motive. We have to figure out what happened, and then we can talk about motive. And then my second part of that answer is always, then I explain what I think the motive is. So today we're going to do that second part. We're going to sort of walk listeners and viewers through why we think, if the Russians did take MH370, why they would have done it, what would have been the motive, what would they have hoped to gain?
Yeah, that's interesting because everyone asked me why.
Yeah.
And I asked you why when I first met you.
Yeah.
So I like to start with motive and go in the other direction. But
I think people do like it. Yeah, I think a lot of people do. It's kind of a human instinct. I think when an attorney or a district attorney takes a case to trial, you know, one of the things they talk about is what is the suspect's motive, right?
Mm-hmm.
But in order to talk about motive, you really have to understand what happened first. And you know, there's a tendency in a lot of the discourse about MH370 people start with motive. They're like, you know, I think the Americans would do this kind of thing, or you know, I think the Chinese would want to steal this technology, and then try to build downwards from the motive.
You did
I think
the
motive was like the tip of the pyramid.
Yeah, you did the total opposite in your research. You tried to figure out what happened, and now you're trying to figure out why.
This whole podcast is kind of an argument for building from the ground up, building a foundation and then building upwards. So finally we've reached the top of the pyramid, and we can say, okay, we're going to tell you the thing you've been wanting to hear. So maybe without further ado, although we've had plenty of ado.
Well, that's okay, because I will say in the last episode we did talk about how, right?
Right.
So last episode, episode 27, was about where this plane could have gone in Kazakhstan and Russia. So a good one to refer back to, but yes, you're right. Now we are going to talk about why. And before you in order to understand anything about this, you have to understand Russia, and you have to understand the man in charge of Russia, Vladimir Putin.
Because it's his motives. Because he's the guy that pulls the strings, right? Everything ultimately goes back to Putin. When I first started talking about this and thinking about it and running it past some people who are knowledgeable about this part of the world, one of my friends said, you know, actually, Russia is not so monolithic as a lot of people in the West think. There's different power centers, and it's kind of more of like the czar is in Moscow, but then there's little fiefdoms here and there. I think this is such a big operation that it would have to be from the very, very top.
And not only would it have to be from the very top, but some of the theories that people say, like there was a bunch of gold on the plane, or this was like a revenge move or something, that's like small potatoes in terms of something this grandiose from Putin.
You know, one of the objections that I think people have about the idea of a Russian hijack is that it is so ambitious. It is so technically complicated. It is so risky. It is such an amazing undertaking that it's almost like on the scale of a moonshot. And so it's something that could only be done for sort of strategic level reasons. And that is not, I don't think it could have anything to do with, oh, they wanted to steal technology, or they wanted to have revenge against Malaysia for the 1MDB scandal or something like that. I think you would only want to undertake something like this for strategic level reasons. And when I talk strategic level, it's like something that's going to change the balance of power in the world. It's going to change the nature of the game in world politics.
Yeah. And that's the only way we're going to be able to get to that part is if we kind of explain how Russia and Putin got here. So I think that we should talk a little bit about that.
Yeah.
Clearly, there are many history lessons and books written about Putin, and we can't replace that in one episode. But let's talk about his history. Let's talk about what this guy is like now, and then how that all relates into the disappearance of MH370.
Yeah, because when we're talking about motive, we're talking about who's making the decision and what is the context that that decision is being made. And so the decision maker here is Vladimir Putin. He was born in 1952 in Leningrad, which at the time was just emerging from this absolute slaughterhouse of World War II. The siege of Leningrad was the longest siege of the war. It was an absolutely brutal slog. His parents like narrowly survived. One of his older brothers died in the massive famine that was part of that siege. So he emerged into a world in which, you know, foreign invasion, foreign threat was not an abstract idea at all. It was something that was very real and visceral.
So like many young Soviet men and women, the guy entered the KGB. He was stationed in East Germany, but he was not happy during the fall of the Soviet Union. Many people were happy. He was not happy. He called it the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the century.
Right.
Turns out he made a career being pretty much the opposite of what a communist would be.
Well, in a sense, because I think, Andy, and you know, I think you're more knowledgeable about this, and maybe I can insert a parenthetical here that we've been talking about MH370, and it's tended to focus on my research into the mystery, and it's involved a lot of aviation, aeronautical stuff, and a little bit of marine biology and other things. But you have a background, you have a background, obviously people know about On Milwaukee, but you also have a political background. Maybe you could just sort of, because I think people should know that you're not just Whistling Dixie here. You have a reason to talk.
No, I'm partially Whistling Dixie, but I do know of what I speak to, at least to a certain extent. I went to the Elliott School of International Affairs at George Washington University and majored in international affairs and spent a lot of time learning about Soviet American relations and history, and had some pretty amazing professors with, I swear to God, some of those guys were CIA. I will stand with that, stand by that. But then I did work at the White House in the Clinton administration in the Office of Communications. And I've stayed close to a lot of those people, even though I live in Milwaukee and not Washington, D.C. anymore. So I don't know what you and your friends talk about, but when I'm talking to my friends from Capitol Hill and the White House and the State Department, our conversations are pretty nerdy and probably bugged at this point. I was just talking to a friend in the Foreign Service who's stationed in Eastern Europe. Without giving too much of his detail away, he this is the kind of stuff that he deals with every day.
Okay.
And we're looking at getting some experts on this topic, because I mean, you could take many classes in Vladimir Putin and only begin to scratch the surface. So this is a topic that, while I wouldn't call myself a specific expert on, it's at least a hobby, and I'm appalled by Vladimir Putin.
Right.
So I've said to you, Jeff, that I think this theory that the plane went north is a valid one.
Right.
But even if we're wrong, even if you're wrong, and it sheds light on the many, many things that Putin has done that are completely awful and verifiable, I don't feel terribly guilty about talking about him in this light.
Yeah, I think that's a really excellent point, that when I started to fear that MH370 was a Russian intelligence operation, it terrified me, because not only was it horrifying to think that, you know, these 239 people might have been done in by a Russian spy agency, but the idea that they had gotten away with it, that mm-hmm. nobody had in the halls of power in the West had been able to grok that this thing had been done, and that if that was the case, then Russia would have kind of a free hand to do more such things. And that came true. I mean, regardless of whether MH370 was hijacked by Russians, all the bad things that I feared did come to pass. And so we're going to be talking about those things And we're going to look at that. The argument is that if you see MH370 as the start of a new geopolitical era, which is characterized by aggression, subversion, and the spread of autocracy, those things are all valid. That movement did happen regardless of whether MH370 was somehow a part of it or not.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, for sure. It's almost like a start of a new Cold War.
Yeah.
And if it is, Russia's winning.
I would take out the like. It is not like a Cold War. It is literally and exactly a Cold War. It's fought using the same methods. The stakes are the same. It is, what kind of world are we going to live in? Are we going to live in a world, a liberal democracy, or are we going to live in some kind of totalitarian?
I think you should clarify when you say liberal democracy, because people who aren't as well versed in political science think, okay, when they hear liberal, they say, oh, he's talking about
like Democrats.
That's not what that means.
Something.
That, yeah, that's not what you mean, Jeff. No. A liberal democracy is the definition of what the West is, regardless of the political party in charge.
Yeah, what we mean is a world in which people get to vote, in which people's in which people have their collective needs met by a government that is responsive to their desires because they vote.
So let's talk about what Russia looked like, or the former Soviet Union, around the time of the collapse of the Soviet Union, when Putin was cutting his teeth in this stuff. Obviously, under
communism. He's like a station chief in Dresden in East Germany.
Okay.
And he sees this world collapse. I mean, everything that he has worked for is falling apart. And, you know, I think there's like kind of two separate issues here. One is pride in Russia, pride in the Soviet Union, pride in the strength in the empire, pride in having defeated Nazi Germany, pride in being a model for how the world should conduct itself. And at the time, there were these two superpowers, the United States, which was promoting, as we were talking about, liberal democracy and capitalism. And on the other hand, the socialist vision of the world, which was China and Russia, Vietnam, Cuba, etc. And it was really a clash of these two worldviews that seemed like it could go either way throughout the 70s. I remember being in like 79 and feeling like we were losing. Mm-hmm. Then Reagan came to power and suddenly it fell apart. And I think everyone was shocked. I think the West was shocked. I think Russia was shocked. I think Putin was shocked. You know, that all of us, you know, it kind of reminds me of the collapse of Germany in 1918. The Germans thought they were winning World War I. And then when they suddenly lost, a lot of them couldn't really handle it, including a young man named Adolf Hitler, right?
Yeah.
And so this sense of like, we were great, it was stolen from us, we deserve our rightful place back, is a very motivating idea.
Yeah, say what you want about Reagan, but he outspent the Soviets so much that he brought them to their knees. And suddenly you had this crazy situation, you know, around 1990, where all this state-owned stuff became like up for grabs. And Russia was like the Wild West in the early days of the Russian Federation.
Yeah.
It was good for some people. It was great for some people. And it was terrible for other people. Birth rates were plunging. Life expectancy was dropping. I mean, the nation was like, in a way, it was.
I went to Russia for the first time in 92. I was living in Hong Kong at the time, and a trade delegation came down from Vladivostok, and I met them, and they said, you should come visit. And so I did. And then I went back the following summer, and I just hung out, rented an apartment, got really, really drunk.
Yeah.
Vodka. And, you know, just, and I said to the Russians, I said, like, you're now free of the shackles of this terrible system. You have all this energy. It's like people power. And you're going to forge a great path. Like everything is bright. And I was really shocked when the Russians that I was talking to were like, no, it's not going to be like that.
Well, people outside of Russia were super excited. They were like this fledgling democracy. Like they were like our buddies. We were like there to help. Boris Yeltsin comes into power. It turns out he was a piece of work.
Well, there was this kind of belief that was very common. I keep thinking about the people power in the Philippines, this idea that people will that democracy will just rise up and overthrow. And that if you give people democracy and you give people capitalism, they will just instinctively do the right thing. And so this view, which I think has been since discredited by what happened in the years that followed, but this guy named Jeffrey Sachs from Harvard went over and was basically advising the Russians on what they should do. And basically said, just like, take all of your stuff and just throw open the doors, just auction everything off, give people certificates so everybody can own a part of the state. And so basically it was, like you said, the Wild West, and it was a free for all. These kind of mobsters and gangsters and well-positioned elites just sort of stole everything.
Yeah, it was a very Clintonian attitude, actually, because that's when I was at the White House, when they were like, just put democracy in front of them and good things will happen.
Right.
Well,
it was naive in retrospect.
It was pretty naive because it just opened the door for these oligarchs and, you know, organized crime and mobsters and, you know, people who could come in, I mean, and just like invest or sign up for shady things. Like when we look at that document from Blaine Gibson with whatever company he bought into in Siberia, I mean, it was just crazy, crazy shit back then.
So Blaine Allen Gibson was roaming around Russia at this time, advising people on deals, trying to do joint ventures. That's what everyone in Russia was like. I've got this institution of nuclear physicists, and we're making toothpaste tube fillers or something, and we want to do a joint venture. And so Blaine Allen Gibson's company started then. The furniture company by the two Ukrainians in the back of the plane started then.
Yep.
The timber products company owned by the Russian in the first class started then. Everything dates to that era.
Yeah, so it got kind of bad for Boris Yeltsin. The oligarchs, the looters, the mobsters. I mean, they were like taking over everything, and suddenly Yeltsin is in a position, and we're going to talk about even more of this soon. But Yeltsin gets in a position where if he steps down, he's afraid that he is going to get sent to the gulag or executed
because he has looted. Because he is a drunk I don't know, criminal is a strong word, but he's basically enriching himself at the state expense.
Yeah. So what does he do? He picks Vladimir Putin.
But Putin was now a functionary in the city government of St. Petersburg.
He was a mayor.
Which is what Leningrad had become.
Yeah.
And he basically...
Was he the governor or the mayor?
It was the office... was the mayor, wasn't it?
I think he was the mayor, yeah. I think he was the mayor.
That guy was... He had basically helped somebody get away with some corruption. And so Yeltsin was like, oh, this guy is really good. Because here's the thing. Maybe you can explain this better than me, Andy, but it's not just a particularly Russian thing, but it's a thing about dictators in general, where it's like, you can't get off the throne. You can't leave. You can't retire. Because if you do, what? I mean...
Yeah, well, at best, you get imprisoned. And in a place like Russia, you fall out of a window onto a steel fence or something. I mean, this is the kind of place that has a history for hundreds of years of these kinds of things happening. So Yeltsin was backed into a corner. So he thought that if he picked someone who wasn't too threatening and would protect himself or protect Yeltsin and his family.
So basically he was in the market for like, I need to find somebody who I can hand the keys of the kingdom to on one condition. Like I have only one requirement for this job, which is don't kill me or throw me in jail.
Right. So that worked, at least for Yeltsin.
So in 1999, he appoints Putin head of the FSB, which is what the KGB has become, which is a great thing for Putin because that's what he is. He's a spy. And then like within months, he names him as his actual successor.
Nobody at the time, and I remember this, nobody thought Putin was going to last.
Well, nobody had heard of him, right?
No, it's just, he was not, he didn't rise to the ranks in the same sort of way that previous Soviet leaders had. He was a nobody. And the government seemed to, like it was doomed to fail. In September of 1999, things were looking pretty terrible in Russia. And then there was this horrific, we'll call it a catastrophe, act of terrorism. There's a series of deadly bombings that struck four apartment buildings. And 300 Russians were killed, more than 1,000 were injured, and the government conveniently blamed Chechen terrorists and launched a war of reprisal, which, like they say, like 200,000 civilians were killed.
Right.
And suddenly Putin's popularity has soared. He's the man. He spoke to the nationalism of this vulnerable country, and things took off for him.
Right. So it was a bit like 9/11 for George Bush, right?
Yeah, it really
was. Where it's like this terrible thing happened and everyone kind of rallies around. Okay, so the theory has been afoot. I don't even know if it's a theory or if it's just a fact at this point, but the question is, did Chechen insurrectionists or terrorists blow up these buildings, or did Putin do it as a false flag for the specific purpose of rallying people around this outrage?
I think at the time, the concept of a false flag was like, nobody would have ever even thought that.
It seemed like a conspiracy
theory. Yeah, we were operating in like a different time back then.
Yeah.
It was like, and also people weren't that scared of Putin. I mean, George W. Bush met him. I have a quote here. You probably remember
this. Into his soul or something.
It's very close to that, but I want to get it exactly right. He said, sure. In 2001, George W. Bush met with Putin. He said, I almost want to do this in his voice, but I'm not going to. He said, I looked the man in the eye. I found him to be very straightforward and trustworthy. I was able to get a sense of his soul.
My God.
Now, admittedly, he has since regretted saying that, but yeah. The West was not appalled by this guy at this point. Or if they were, it was in smaller circles. We still thought this was a guy we could work with.
You know, it's almost like we'd been scared of the Soviet Union for so long. I was born in 1966, and so I grew up in the heart of the Cold War, in the heart of the nuclear paranoia age, where the atomic scientists' clock was always like 1 minute to midnight. Mm-hmm. And there were all these movies about like the world being blown up with nuclear bombs. And then all of a sudden it went away. Do you know the Jackson Browne song, Lawyers in Love? I mean, it's like it's literally came true. It's like the Russians just like went away. They just vanished. And so I feel like in the 90s, there was this sudden sense of like the Russians were entirely comical. Like the idea that we'd been ever afraid of them was ridiculous. I remember going to Vladivostok and seeing the Pacific Fleet in this formerly secret city of Vladivostok and really like this thing looks like it was welded by drunken high school students.
It probably was.
It probably was.
I think and I'm a little younger than you, but I absolutely remember the terror and the fear of the 80s and looking up in the sky thinking, you know, the day after is about to happen.
Right.
And then all of a sudden the 90s come along. It's like, whew, all right.
But it was like, why are we ever afraid of these people?
We didn't know.
And this guy who actually I know, Gary Steingart, is Russian-American novelist who wrote a book about that was sort of just like ridiculing Russians as this sort of comically hapless, how could we possibly be scared of them? And I think that Putin understood that. I think a lot of Russians knew that they had become kind of risible. Mm-hmm. And they seethed. And I think Putin really seethed.
Yeah, he seethed and he wanted to prove the West wrong.
Yeah.
So, and under a variety of unusual extra things about this guy, I don't have full detail on, so maybe you do. I mean, he has this kind of mystical ethos with this kind of like Rasputin type character who the Putin whisperer. He does have kind of a mystical religious background, but he is like, this guy has, he believes Russia is, he wants to take Russia back to a different time.
Well, it's like make Russia great again.
Yeah.
I mean, it's that same kind of deeply conservative / authoritarian worldview where it's like there was this era of greatness sometime in the mystical past. It involves Russian Orthodox religion. It involves Russianness in some sort of vague sense. And it involves, manliness and strength. And he's like bareback. He likes to be like seen like without a shirt on. And he's like riding horses.
He's shooting guns. He's like allegedly excellent at judo, I believe. But I don't know if he's really excellent at it or if it's just like his cult of personality.
Let's put it this way. Nobody
beats loses.
Him.
Right.
He never loses.
So everyone he's ruthless. Everyone's, you don't want to beat Vladimir Putin match. No. He's ruthlessly like consolidating his power at this point.
Right.
He's jailing the oligarchs who are not on his side. He's you know,
every power that he has, he's like taking a little more power, a little more power, a little more power. And he sits the oligarchs down at one point and he's like, says like, you have to like fall in line. And there's some oligarchs who are like pushing back against him, who don't want to like let him consolidate all his power. And he basically just, you know, wipes them out.
Yeah. So under this like shiny new veneer of nationalism, the corruption is just like running rampant. And the Russian Federation did have a spectacular run of growth from 1996 to 2008. And then, like the rest of the world, the Russian economy stalled in the wake of this worldwide financial crisis.
Yeah.
And yet, Putin as a guy is living the high life. And I want to talk a little, Jeff, about what he's like as a person.
Yeah.
Because I think that while one may not see the connection between that and MH370 or the connection between him as a person and his motives for MH370.
Okay.
I think it's worth discussing because I think there are a lot of people who still don't really know what this guy is. People in the United States are like, he's not so bad.
Right. Like, well, no, he's very popular amongst the Republican Party right now for reasons we'll get into.
Yeah.
So I think that's beyond the scope of today's thing, but you know.
Yeah. So, you know, he just won this election and I almost have to use air quotes to call it an election because.
Yeah. You're talking about the one now, 2024.
Yeah. People were like, you know, forced at gunpoint to vote for him. And right. That a lot means that he can remain in office until 2030. He's already been there for what do we say, 24 years? Right. So, and frankly, he can stay there as long as he wants. So that would be three full decades of leading Russia as president or prime minister. He's switched back and forth in the early years to kind of get around term limits and stuff. But now that's just off the table.
That was back in the days when he had to sort of pay lip service to the sort of the rules, as it were.
Right. Now he makes the rules and that nobody questions them. I want to point out that there are currently 1,162 political prisoners in and around Russia, which frankly seems low to me. I thought there would be more than that.
Well, they keep getting smaller, right? Because like, do we know? Have they even said why Navalny died? He just died. Unfortunate.
Unfortunate. But being an outspoken person in Russia is a pretty dangerous thing.
Yeah.
So yeah, let's just talk about him as a person.
He's rich. All right. Tell me about how he's rich.
Vladimir Putin is not just rich. He's very possibly the richest person on earth. People think that he's worth $200 billion, which would far eclipse, you know, Elon Musk or Jeff Bezos. Some of the stuff that this guy has accumulated on the backs of the Russian people is absolutely stunning. He's got this Black Sea mansion. It's a $1.4 billion mansion. With 700 cars and 700 cars and 58 planes and helicopters. Meanwhile, his official salary is $140,000 a year, and he maintains a small apartment in Moscow, I believe.
Do they even? They still maintain that sort of pretense that he has like,
he does?
A reasonable.
Yeah, he says he has a trailer and three cars.
But I mean, it's almost like he has king-like power. So it's almost like, can you even really put a limit on his? I mean, he owns Russia, basically.
Yeah, it's pretty hard to even say he only is worth $200 billion. But he lives an unbelievably lavish lifestyle.
Okay.
He has so they call this this mansion his country cottage.
Right.
It's perched atop a cliff. It's said to, because I don't think a lot of people have seen it, boast a marble swimming pool adorned with statues of Greek gods, an amphitheater, a state of the art ice hockey rink. Oh yeah, he's also apparently very good at hockey.
Again, like, he never loses.
Yeah,
he's so good that he never loses.
He's excellent at hockey. He's got a Vegas style casino, and he has his own nightclub. Oh, by the way, he also has 19 other houses, and his own $716 million plane that is called the Flying Kremlin.
But is he happy?
Well, that's a great question because he is divorced, actually.
Mm-hmm.
He was married, you know, in his youth to a respectable Soviet woman, Ludmilla. Okay. The Russian newspaper Muscovy correspondent in 2008 said that he might be looking to get a divorce. 2 days later, he shuts down the newspaper. And then 5 years later, he announces that they actually had separated. But he allegedly has a mistress, which shouldn't surprise anyone. It's a former Soviet gymnast.
But he's very, I think the information that you're laying on us right now is like kind of like through the rumor mill, right? He's not, he doesn't like appear on the balcony with his, you know, personal Evita Peron, right? This is
no,
all,
he's really
his whole
discreet
family life
it.
Seems shrouded in mystery, yeah?
Yeah, it totally is. And he recently built his mistress another gigantic palace, and she's actually sanctioned by the US. So it's, even though he's like kind of discreet about it, everyone else knows about it as well.
Right. It's hard to be discreet, like when you're moving around on like a 600-foot yacht, which was I think his yacht was recently impounded in Italy or something.
A lot of his stuff is getting impounded. He also has a super fancy train, a ghost train.
Okay.
And
what is a ghost train?
It's a 22-car train that he uses to traverse Russia because he's also kind of paranoid.
Sure.
And probably rightfully so. It's not only is it armored, it includes, it's very opulent, includes a fully equipped gym, skincare and massage parlor with anti-aging machines.
And I can only imagine what a Russian anti-aging machine
is. I don't know, but he has a Turkish bath steam room.
Sure.
A movie theater inside this train.
Yeah.
Bulletproof doors, windows. And he also has like a full service hospital in there, which a lot of people are not super happy about given the shortage of medical supplies for his.
And why is it called a ghost train? Just because it's secret?
I assume so.
Like, I mean, it sounds
outwardly,
cool.
It's not outwardly.
I would definitely call my train the ghost train, you know.
Because it doesn't exist.
Really
because, yeah.
Sounds cool.
It does sound cool. I'm just trying to point out like what this guy is like. Because...
this is all not surprising at all. He's in this world of just like megalomania and corruption and just like everything is me and money is power. I mean, he can't really spend his money. He can't go buy a steak, but what he can do is like divvy it out as power and buy things and buy connections and bribe people and make things happen overseas. But I think an important thing to understand about Russian society and politics and culture is that in the West, we have until recently, fairly distinct divisions between organized crime, intelligence, politics, and wealthy people. Like these are all fairly defined different groups. In Russia, all of these things are heavily entwined. Organized crime is in politics, is in business, is in espionage. And so we tend to think of like the Cosa Nostra and the CIA as being sort of polar opposites of each other. In Russia, they're all part of the same team.
And that's really why I wanted to bring all this stuff up, because I want to talk about the elements of a kleptocracy. And then I think we should get back into kind of the timeline, because it helps explain all of these things.
Okay.
I mean, essentially, a kleptocracy means that the interests of the ruling elite and the interests of the state diverge. So... throughout his career, he's just, you know, looted Russia and
l'état c'est moi. I am the state. And everything that is good for the state is good for me. And everything that is good for me is good for the state. And everything the state owns, I own.
And just similar to Louis the 14th or the 16th who said that?
Tick, 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 tick. Yeah. Hey, Louis. Let's say
you're
going to
go out there and throw
Louis.
Out that. You're going to go out there and throw that statement out. I want you to back it up. I can't remember which Louis that was either. But similarly, so the consequences of being a kleptocrat is you can't surrender power. Because, as we said, if you step down, best case scenario, you're imprisoned. More practically, you're executed.
And there's another threat too, though, which is the people, because there are still these people. And even though they have to vote for you, they might not like it. And having had the czar overthrown and having had the Communist Party essentially collapse, he's very much aware that you can't just, sheer willpower isn't enough to maintain an autocratic power, right? And so it's important that the people receive a message that, well, there's a certain mindset. Maybe you want to talk about.
Yeah.
That.
So this is part two, and then part three, which is the through line to everything else that we've been talking about. The consequence of the second consequence of your kleptocracy is that people are like, this is not cool. We can't find, you know, we can't have bread while you're out there shooting bears and riding horses shirtless and living in your Dhaka. And people start to protest, people start to complain, and he can shut it down. He can own state media, but now he's got a problem. And the way kleptocrats respond to this criticism is they become super patriots. So they assume the mantle of defenders of the nation.
Defenders of the faith.
Yeah. This may sound familiar to some Americans.
Yeah.
They employ radical nationalistic ideas. They become like super propagandists. They vilify their opponents as pawns or scum. You know, when challenged at home, they lash out at foreign enemies. So they change the narrative.
And there's another part of it too, which we can get into more in the future, but it's like you sort of create a very cynical information environment. Peter Pomerantsev, I've quoted this before, I think, wrote a book called Nothing is True and Everything is Possible. And you just basically flood the zone with conspiracy theories and nonsense and ivermectin and just, vaccines don't really work. And like, you don't know what's true. And the idea isn't to create so much an alternate understanding of the world as to just flood the zone with like a million different ridiculous, incredible theories, none of which make any sense. And you just become very cynical and you kind of become passive.
Yeah. And we're living in a world right now where there's just a nonstop barrage of real, fake, cockamamie news and news sources. I mean, you could even argue that the podcast world is full of this.
Yeah.
Certainly social media is, and it just becomes so overwhelming that people can't process it.
This podcast, we are part of that struggle.
Yeah.
This podcast is existing in a world of where like the Joe Rogan podcast is like the dominant force in podcasting. And it is Joe Rogan is an example of this kind of promulgation of just nonsense, like the inability to discriminate truth from falsehood.
I mean, I live in Wisconsin and you live in New York, so perhaps you already know that your quarterback for the Jets and the former Packers quarterback, Aaron Rodgers, can basically say anything he wants about anything.
Right.
And people are like, oh yeah, Aaron Rodgers said it. And
so
like,
you and I
have a venue for everything.
This thing that we're doing right now is an attempt, it's an experiment to see is if we can somehow create a little bubble of logic and careful analysis of the world in a way that tries to assemble something durable, something that can endure and survive and even spread in a world that's full of nonsense.
You just basically summed up why I'm doing this, Jeff. It's to see if we can, in our own way, restore a little common sense to a really complicated and ugly and weird
and to
issue.
Make it harder, as you know, people are like, oh, in the comments are like, there's always people like, oh, how come you're spreading this nonsense? Even Mike Exner in the independent group is like, yeah, this is a ridiculous theory. It's irresponsible. We are fighting for our epistemic lives here, trying to understand the world. Okay, enough on that.
Yeah,
you know,
let's
that
fast forward. I love the soapbox. So people can decide for themselves if they think we're legit or part of the problem or part of the solution. Fast forward to 2013. Right. And this is where the story continues.
Okay.
Things are a crisis in Ukraine.
Right. And so here is, we started to talk about how he grew up in this post-war wreckage of Leningrad. This acute sense of the vulnerability of being both a mighty nation, but a vulnerable nation, and watching the West and having this idea that Russia is supposed to be growing to become a kind of junior partner of the West, following the model of the West, but feeling that we have our own greatness. We shouldn't be a part of the West. We should be a rival to the West, or maybe we should dominate the West, and feeling like the West is trying to take us over. So after the Soviet Union fell apart, there were parts of it like Lithuania, Estonia, Latvia that actually became part of NATO and places that were once part of the Soviet umbrella, like Czechoslovakia and East Germany, Hungary, Romania, they're now becoming part of the West. Like their former empire is being absorbed. And this is perceived by Putin as being very threatening, like existentially threatening.
Absolutely.
And, you know, we just had this thing that happened where Tucker Carlson went over to Moscow to interview Putin. And people were like kind of baffled that Putin spent all this time talking about, you know, Yaroslav the Magnificent or something from the Middle Ages. And they're like, why is he talking about the Middle Ages? Because in Russian history, the Russian state begins with Ukraine. Like that's where the Vikings came down and met the Slavs and in the context of the Eastern Roman Empire, the Byzantium, it all kind of out of this swirl of medieval stuff emerges what becomes Russia. And so to them, this is really like their kind of spiritual heartland. So Ukraine was a client state. The Soviet Union had broken up, but it remained a client state of Moscow. This guy, Viktor Yanukovych, and then he gets toppled.
Yeah, February 2014, there's this revolution, and that does not sit well with Putin. He wants to bring things back to the way they were.
So Eastern Europe was going through what they called the series of color revolutions, where basically having tasted freedom, these pro-democracy movements basically gathered steam, and elections happened, and despite the shenanigans of the, you know, ex-KGB type people, the Democrats won, and there was a people power movement in the Maidan Square in Kyiv, in Ukraine. Snipers were shooting at them. People died, but the people power prevailed, and Yanukovych was forced out.
So this is where it gets crazy. So Russia has been thinking about this for some time. They have like a military doctrine for this. Could they just go in, guns blazing, and re-overthrow the government? Putin thinks no, because that would trigger a world war. So instead, he does this very peculiar covert operation.
So there's this idea, we can call it hybrid warfare. And the idea is that if you what's sometimes called kinetic warfare, or just sort of straight up, you know, guns, tanks, and airplanes kind of warfare, like when you roll over the border and take over Hungary or Czechoslovakia, as the Soviet Union had done, it's seen as an invasion. It's seen as an act of war, and now you're in war, and that is a scary thing to undertake. Russia is not as strong as NATO. And this was a really scary thing to undertake. So rather than just roll tanks across the border, which of course he did later, but at the time, you know, in 2013, yeah, going into 2014, he's thinking, how can I stop this? How can I prevent this historic part of the Russian heartland from being taken over? In his view, this was in his view, a coup d'etat. A seizure of what is something inherently Russian by the West. This is a red line for him. And so he engages in this, what we call hybrid warfare, where it's basically using techniques of espionage, very Cold War, kind of like you're doing something under the cover of doing something else. There were these people dressed up in uniforms that had no signature on them.
They didn't have insignias. They were like taken off.
So who were they? They're almost like Martians. And so they called them little green men.
Yeah.
There were these mysterious Russians. People that showed up, yeah, and they just like took over. They took over, yeah, Crimea, this peninsula that has historically been part of Russia. It was granted to Ukraine under the Soviet Union. And now Putin felt like it should be back to him. And they seized it.
And he totally got away with it. People were outraged. On the other hand, average people were sort of like, okay.
Well, at the time, you know, I remember all the, you know, well-intentioned journalists, you know, who were told, you know, the claim was like, this is not Russia. And there was these sort of, it was portrayed as kind of indigenous, you know, militias rising up and just seizing, mm-hmm, power kind of spontaneously on their own. They were very displeased with how things had happened, and they wanted to just, you know, assert their rights, and they were afraid of, you know, being persecuted because they were pro-Russia. And of course, it was ridiculous. you know, this was a Russian, you know, military intelligence operation from beginning to end. But the West bought it to a large extent, but to an extent that they didn't. And so even though the response was more muted than it would have been to just tanks rolling across the border, the United States did on March 6th declare that it was imposing sanctions, economic sanctions against Russia for this, you know, act of aggression, essentially.
They were sanctioned, but they were not sanctioned to the level that...
There were baby sanctions by the standards of what would come later.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
You know, I remember at that time I tweeted probably the dumbest thing I've ever tweeted. And that's saying a lot because I've tweeted a lot of dumb things. But I tweeted something, and I'll find it because I've apologized for it. But I tweeted something to the extent of like, if Putin wants Crimea, let him have it because it's better than World War III. That was the dumbest thing I've ever said in my life. I mean, because what we did is we gave him the green light to go farther.
There was still a lot of uproar, I think, particularly in Europe. But there was a lot of attention at the time, and we're starting to converge our storyline back onto mm-hmm. MH370. At the time, there was a lot of, it was the number one story at the time.
That it was
Russia
growing.
Had done this evil thing. And there was, yeah. It was very concerning. I think people remembered World War II and the appeasement after the mm-hmm. annexation of the Sudetenland, all that, Alistair Chamberlain, all that. And there was this fear that if we let him get away with this, he will take more, which turned out to be correct.
It sure did.
But there was a lot of anger and a lot of outrage. And the focus of the world at that time was on Putin, on Russia.
Right. So on Thursday, March 6th, Obama imposes these sanctions. And Sergey Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, who's still a player today, he declared that those sanctions would, quote, inevitably hit the United States like a boomerang.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It sounds like a threat.
What happens the next day, Jeff?
And so the very next day, in European time, was certainly in American time, that's when MH370 disappears. And all of a sudden, certainly CNN didn't pay any more attention to Crimea. And this incredible event that just was this baffling mystery. How could this happen? And then, you know, the story kept taking these incredible turns where we found out new evidence would emerge. And so for a period of several months, because of this plane disappearing, basically the Crimea fell off the radar. And it was off the radar, you know, pretty much until July when another Malaysian Airlines 777 gets shot down by Russian military intelligence over.
Parenthetically, do you remember what the lead story of the day was on September 10th, 2001? I'll just tell you. It was about Gary Condit. Remember that guy?
Oh, like a corrupt politician or something?
Yeah, he was the guy who was his intern, the one he was having the affair with, disappeared. Was found dead. People were wondering what he had to do with it.
Oh, that's right. That's right. I totally forgot about that. Yeah, it was great for Gary Condit.
Of course you forgot about it, because on September 11th, 2001, there was no more air for that story ever again.
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, Putin changed the story away from Crimea to the disappearance of MH370 in one day.
So, if you don't like the conversation, change the topic, right? Yeah. And the topic was definitely changed by this act. Whoever did it, it was the heat was off Putin, and people. You know, there was a risk. I mean, a lot of people have reached out to me since we started talking about this and said, well, you know, there was a terrible risk that this would pose. What if he got caught? And I think that was like a reason why it was such a carefully thought out and sort of immaculately planned operation. It was, I think it was a test, because to see if he could get away with it, to see how close he came. And I think if, for instance, by chance, some Navy ship had detected this plane flying over the Andaman Islands or something, mm-hmm. I think it would have been interesting to see if somebody would have tried to make the claim at the time, oh, Putin, this is actually a Russian operation, because we can see how the reaction to my trying to like shine a light on all this, people, there's a strong unwillingness to believe that they could have done this. And, you know, we've talked before about the parallels with Assad in Syria using chemical weapons, and and people being horrified by this prospect, and Obama saying, if you're doing this, we will punish you. There's a red line about this. And then when Bellingcat revealed that, in fact, they had been using chemical weapons, like, they just didn't want to hear about it. And of course, Obama didn't want to impose sanctions. And so there was a strong disincentive to want to think that Russia did this. And we're going to talk some more in upcoming episodes about how, when I started to talk about this theory, the reception that it got, which is, it was pretty frosty, frankly.
Chilly. Yeah, it wasn't great. I think that I've thought this all along, because people say, how did Russia get away with this? Okay, for all the reasons we just said, but also because there was nothing Malaysia could do about it.
Right.
So it was a pretty good test case to try something on a country that can't respond. The part that does confuse me a little bit is how many Chinese people were on that plane.
Right.
And if Russia did this, why they would anger their ally.
I would be careful to say that China is a strong ally of Russia. I think they are. I think they have historically been extremely wary of each other. They are, you know, they are just for hundreds of years been rivals, and they've been, you know, vying for the same Eurasian continent.
Okay.
And I've said before that, like, why this plane? Why risk China? The hack that was available, if this plane was hacked, the hack that was available was very rare. Very few planes have the ability to be hijacked in this way. And so I don't think they had an incredibly wide range of choices. But, you know, I think we really glanced over the idea that Putin had blown up these apartment buildings with his own people inside for the mere benefit of getting people excited about a war with Chechnya.
Right. I mean, whatever motive you want to assign, even my friend at the State Department said, this is not outside the, even if you don't believe it, this is the kind of stuff that Putin would just do without any
reservation. He's a very ruthless guy. He's a guy who is not shy about killing civilians. He's a guy who's not shy about shooting down airplanes. Now, we argued in MH17, when we did our episode about MH17, that was a deliberate act. That is a controversial premise. But we know that he shot down Prigozhin's plane or blew it up.
Yeah.
I mean, and so if you look, people talk about means, motive, and opportunity. This is a guy who had a motive. This is a guy who has the means, because Russia, we haven't really talked about it, but Russia has the kind of high-tech industries, aviation industries, satellite communications industries, electronic warfare industries. They are one of the few nations in the world that has all of the technical knowledge to do this kind of thing.
Yeah, and I'd like to point out that, again, he's killed more than 20 of his own political, or people he views as challenges to him. He's tried to kill way more than that.
Yeah.
And he's done a lot of this on foreign soil.
Yeah.
So
yes, he's not shy about
right
killing
these aren't
people,
just people
abroad or
Russia.
Killing foreigners. Yeah.
And these are people in London. These are people in the United States. I mean, this is what this guy does. So give that some thought as you think about whether, not you, but our viewers and listeners should give that some thought as they think about whether this is plausible or not.
Yeah. And just to one more time hit that note about, this is a guy who came up through the KGB. You know, you talk about to a man with a hammer, everything is a nail.
Yeah.
Putin is a guy whose first, like, option A is always like, what is the espionage way to do it? What is the sneaky, indirect, hybrid warfare way of doing it? You know, eventually, when it became clear that he was getting nowhere with Ukraine and things were kind of heading in the wrong direction, then you have the standard conventional invasion that took place, you know, in the current war.
Yeah.
And by that time, like, all the bridges had been burned already. There was no more sense in trying to pretend. But the way all of this conflict with the West, I want to say one more thing about this conflict. Ultimately, Putin's job is to stay in power. That's mm-hmm. his one and only job, is to make sure that he is the guy who's on top of the heap. And it doesn't matter how much people suffer underneath him, but he has to be the guy in charge. And it makes his life is made hard if the Russian people can tune into Russian language programming coming out of Ukraine or Belarus and see people in Ukraine or Belarus living at a high economic level with political and economic freedoms that they don't have. Because then they say, well, why can't I have that? And so a lot of, I think, what's happened in the last 10 years can be interpreted as Putin's attempt to refute the argument that people can live freely. People can't have political freedoms. People can't have economic freedoms. And if they start to think that they can, then you have to suppress them. And you have to convince them that everything that they believe is a lie. You know, Andy, we're about to go into an election here in the United States. And apparently a majority of Americans think that the economy was better under Donald Trump than it was under Joe Biden. And so you can imagine, how can a people try to make their lives better if they're so confused that they are unable to discern better from worse, even when they have lived through it themselves?
People have really short memories, and I think some of these people in power are hoping that people's memories stay short. So maybe it's our job to remind them a little bit that this is not ancient history we're talking about.
No, this is all real. This is all documented. And the epistemic crisis that we are trying to fight against with this podcast is a main weapon in a civilizational struggle that is underway and that could go either way. I mean, Donald Trump right now is polling above Joe Biden.
I'm going to leave it right there and say, if you want to help support what we're doing, please
like
and
save the world, basically.
Please, if you want to save the world, please like and subscribe to Deep Dive MH370. You can also become a member, which is like a super subscriber, through this YouTube channel. You can also visit our website, which is deepdivemh370.com, where you can also become a member. So there are numerous ways to support us there. The show page has even more information. If you are listening to this on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or iHeart or Amazon Music, there are numerous ways to contribute and to help us. You can also think about being a sponsor of Deep Dive MH370. There's information on our show page, or you can quite simply email me at andy@onmilwaukee.com. This episode, I really liked this one because it allowed me to get a couple things off my chest that have been kind of lingering.
I'm glad that we were able to tap your extensive knowledge, and we will do more so because there's a lot more to say about this.
So join us next week as we keep on plugging through this. And thank you, Jeff, for spending your time. I need a good verb.
Пожалуйста, добро пожаловать.
Пожалуйста. Does that mean thank you?
Please, or you're welcome. Yeah.
Yeah. Listen to my Russian or my French.
I really admire Russian culture, Russian people.
I love the Russians.
I would love to see Russia become democratic and free. And I think that would be an amazing thing. And I hope to see that within my lifetime.
I mean, I've looked at my genealogy. I'm Russian and Belarusian largely. So I would like to, you know, my daughter's like, hey, let's go to Belarus. I'm like, no, not now.
Not yet.
Absolutely not. So let's see if we can fix this. Anyway, I digress. Thank you, Jeff. Thank you to our viewers, our listeners, our subscribers, our super fans, our sponsors. And we'll see you next week.
Thanks, Andy. See you later, guys.
Bye-bye.